Hi, everybody. Yes, I'm going to read from a story called On Top of the World, which was originally commissioned by Radio 4. They wanted several writers to write along the theme of I Want to Be Alone. And so this is what I wrote. And it's set in Greenland, and the character is called Elizabeth. I flew in from Iceland in a tiny plane across a sea packed with ice floes, and arrived at surely the smallest airport in the world, an outsized shed stuck in a clearing of slush and gravel. There was seating for six people inside, but the middle-aged woman who manned the desk seemed unconcerned at our arrival. She did not ask for my passport. She knew for sure I would be returning home. England was equatorial compared to Greenland, this most northerly part of the world, where summer stabilized at just below freezing, and winters plummeted to minus 40. There were three other passengers, and none of them could speak English. Just as well, because I had not come here to make friends. I had enough already. Oh yes, my life was a hectic social whirl. I never spent an evening out. And the phone drove me crazy with its constant silence. As for weekends, it's amazing what you can cram into 2 days with the television, DVDs, and celebrity magazines. Years ago, I used to rummage around markets to buy prints of Nigerians arriving at Tilbury Docks in the 50s, postcards of black bus conductors from the 60s, or cheeky 70s teenagers with bushy hair and flares. Framed, they became the family I never knew, childhood friends I never had, the me I could have been. Soon enough, the helicopter was ready to take me on the last leg of my journey to a village of 500 people, for which it was the only access to the outside world, storms permitting. That and a ship which arrived yearly to offload essentials like collapsible houses, satellite dishes, vitamins, and dried fruit. Nothing grew here except summer berries. The diet was, by necessity, carnivorous: seal, hare, polar bear, narwhal, muskox. We took off across the mountains, the propeller whirring noisily as its blades chopped up the sky. The other passengers' excited chatter annoyed me. I scowled. They politely looked away. I was used to that. I looked down at the earth beneath my feet, where snowy mountains dipped and peaked, and I fought the urge to activate the emergency lock and make a most dramatic exit, to free fall with an exhilarated, fading away scream. Now you see me, now you. An hour later, we landed on the top of a hillside. The small village of Itakotamit swooped up from a frozen fjord, its wooden bungalows all bright reds and yellows, prettily offset by snow. I disembarked and became acutely aware that I was now well and truly grounded in the most exquisite sense of the word. I trudged to the waiting taxi. No, not a black cab with a ticking meter and a driver with an attitude, but a skidoo, the kind of ski-come-motorbike vehicle best suited to a village with icy undulating pathways instead of roads. The young driver wore a padded orange jumpsuit and beckoned me to climb aboard. I sat behind as he hurled the beast bumpily along with no regard for this novice passenger. I tried to complain, but he feigned deafness, which was the story of my life. It was mid-morning. The village was deserted. Packs of sledge dogs chained up outside houses started howling like wolves as we zoomed past. There was no market here, only one store, no bars, no cinema, no internet cafe or bingo hall, just a school, a hospital, a police station. We quickly arrived at the house of my guide, Isa, he who would lead me out into the wilderness, my very own Moses, who would carry me over Jordan into the promised land. A stout man in his late 50s, he had thin, deep-set Inuit eyes, which required probing to see behind, something I was not prepared to do. He spoke in broken English, and soon I was attired in bulky Arctic fashion. Size 9 boots to accommodate my 4 pairs of woolen socks, thermal leggings, 2 pairs of fleece trousers underneath sealskin ones, a fleece jacket, a sealskin parka with fur hood, earmuffs, hat, scarves, goose down mittens and goggles. I felt as clumsy and heavy as a yeti, yet never more ready for my journey into the greatest unknown. Isa led me out to his sledge and 13 dogs, all shades of beige, who were straining at the leash. He told me not to go near them. He need not have bothered. I was not overly fond of animals, either. I kept my distance as he began to untie them from a long chain and hook each one up with bright green rope so that they spread out before the sledge in a wide fan. They went wild, barking, jostling for space, desperate to set off, the strongest dogs tugging at the helm. The sledge had a low sloping backrest, against which I sat on a bearskin that covered luggage, tents, and sleeping bags. Hooked over the back were grubby plastic buckets containing the kitchen, which was, basically, a kerosene fire and a single saucepan. Isa sat up front, between me and a tiny white boat which stored our provisions. I was exposed to the elements and the seating was uncomfortable, but I did not mind. Very quickly, Isa was issuing instructions, and the dogs were charging off across the fjord, which was as interminable as the ocean. I couldn't believe I was there, finally, that for thousands of kilometres northwards, there were no other humans but an ice cap 3,000 metres deep, which was pushing the land back into the sea with its weight, and beyond that, the Arctic Ocean and the North Pole. We travelled across the frozen fjords and out into the sea ice, which resembled frosted glass. It was scary at first. What if it cracked? I did not want to drown. Deep down below, I could hear the hollow rumble of water. When the ice was flat, the dogs raced ahead, tongues panting, releasing themselves on the job. It was a vision of jets of urine, which formed beautiful, fluorescent yellow flowers in the luminous snow. I surprised myself by not finding this vulgar display offensive. Sometimes the snow was so deep, the dogs almost slowed down to a full stop, or we came upon frozen waves which rose up in large, jagged lumps where the tide had pushed up against the snow and solidified. The sledge ran over them and landed with a spine-shattering bump. Sculpted icebergs, 100 feet high, were always somewhere on the horizon. Carved from glaciers years ago, they sailed slowly downstream in summer, getting trapped in ice in winter before the melting water released them again. I never got used to the crystal clear visibility, which made everything appear nearer than it actually was. Icebergs, half a day away, looked like I could sprint there in a mere 20 minutes. On sunny days, the ice was so bright, it was blue. I drowned in the cold voluptuousness of it all, feeling the space in my head open up. I did not wash for 5 days, but to my surprise, I barely noticed. We boiled snow for drinking water. It was delicious. I did not miss anyone or anything. How could I? This was the world as it should be, without mankind. Back home, I called my local high road the River of Phlegm. I needed a wetsuit just to wade to the post office. The looks I gave those vile spitters. And it was getting to the point where I was considering wearing surgical gloves to avoid contact with the sticky residue of Joe Public's soiled fingers on shopping baskets or toilet handles, on cafe tables or the handrails on buses and tubes. I had a little runabout for sitting in traffic jams. For 2 hours every day, I'd be trapped behind smoking exhaust pipes, assaulted by a cacophony of impatient horns in the kind of free-for-all jazz improvisation designed to give you a major headache. Too often, I would be hypnotized by the rain dance of my leggy, knobbly-kneed windscreen wipers, my not waving but drowning windscreen wipers. Left, right, squeak, left, right, squeak. That was life before the letter plopped harmlessly through my letterbox onto my doormat one Saturday morning a month ago. Dear Elizabeth Ekandayo, as you are aware, your increasing inability to communicate coherently with your staff has caused us great concern. After several official meetings and warnings, including the offer of professional counselling, we have no option but to terminate. After 15 years of seeing the same faces every morning, the same friendly faces, I realized too late, the people who heard my words, if not my thoughts. Liking the cold is not in my DNA, but I had been drawn to Greenland for years, its emptiness. It was so different to the England I knew and the Africa I did not know. So I bought the ticket. The only ones available were return. It cost me my 2 month severance pay and increased the debt on my credit card. Up yours, Mr. Visa. That day, Isa hunted seal at the tide crack where the frozen sea met the flowing sea. He waited, lying prostrate with his rifle, for the head of a seal to bob up. When it did, he shot it, a soft plop. It flipped onto its side. Blood gushed into the water, staining it red. The Inuits believe that an animal agrees to be killed. They enter into a contract with the hunter. I convinced myself that Isa would understand. Isa got into the boat, rowed out, and brought the seal back. He gutted and skinned it, throwing chunks to the slathering dogs who devoured it in seconds. He cooked seal ribs for dinner, accompanied by powdered mashed potato, our staple vegetable. It was a fine meal. There's an extended twilight here. It won't get dark now until winter, when it stays dark for months. In summer, the sun doesn't set for months. This is the in-between time. This is spring. I shiver in my silver bubble tent. It must be minus 20 degrees, perhaps more. Isa sleeps in his tent on the other side of the dogs, who are chained in a long line, which is staked at both ends to avoid inter-canine battles. They are used to me now, so they do not create havoc when I appear outside my tent. We're camped in front of a glacier. Spread out before me is an Arctic beach, stretching to infinity. The snow is so dry and flat, it's like sand. An iceberg is shaped like a ship against the sky. This is how I imagine the moon to be, so isolated, so strange, so utterly devastating. I have removed my sealskin outerwear and put on my trainers. I won't get very far in them, but I want to walk a while towards the iceberg, which is miles, perhaps a day away. My footprints will be a record of where I have gone. If the ice does not melt, they might still be here next winter, and the next one, and for many winters to come. The cold will numb my feet first, then creep up through my limbs and freeze me in the act of walking. I will become the most extraordinary ice sculpture. This is how I have long imagined it. Thank you.